In July 1929, a 52-year-old Barbe Andreas, being legally separated from his wife, paid a visit to Anna, the daughter of a respectable retired poster clerk in Sears Court. The visit seemed nothing but awkward. As a remote relative, Andreas visited Anna's family regularly. That specific evening, though, they were alone at the house, and Andreas was holding a bottle of liquor. They started to drink, and after a while, and I quote, when he realized that she was in such a condition that she could not longer resist, end of quote, he first gave her a promise of marriage and then seduced her. Anna kept the incident a secret as they continued their intimate relationship for months. At the time, she was still convinced that Andreas would keep his promises. It was only after she discovered that she was pregnant that she revealed the whole truth to her family. In the face of the events, and as Andreas was trying to buy some time, and although he admitted the affair and repeated his readiness to marry Anna, he sounded concerned about the unborn child. He already had two children from his first marriage. Anna and her family, eager to fix the problem, agreed to abandon the baby to an asylum soon after its birth. They kept their promise, but Andreas didn't, as eventually he denied all responsibility. Immediately, Anna's father filed a rape lawsuit against him. Both the judges and the family shared the idea that the defendant, and I quote, within a short period of time, with his malicious and terrible behavior, dispersed devastation and despair, end of quote. However, to make charges against him, legally speaking, was not an easy task. The juries agreed that this was not a rape case, since the element of violence was altogether absent, and Anna continued to meet Andreas on a regular basis for months after the incident, which was, of course, solid proof of consensual sexual relations. On the other hand, they could not charge him with seduction either. Although Anna was a good woman, of good morals, before meeting Andreas a virgin, she was also over 21, and as an adult, she could not be protected by the seduction law. Eventually, the judges charged him with seduction of an intoxicated individual. That was a misdemeanor punishable by a minimum sentence of 3 months. Any attempt to explore rape in its historical specificity reveals at least one of the long-standing discursive banalities of sexual violence. The idea that women reporting their rape more often than not lie. And this is precisely the topic of my paper today. Building on a significant number of pre-trial documents, and more specifically on rape indictments from the Aegean Islands of the first decades of the 20th century, like the one I presented in my opening lines, I focus on women who lied about being sexually abused. In doing so, I want to understand why these girls and their families stood before the local police and legal authorities and reported a consensual sexual relation as a sexual attack. The frequency of such cases in my primary sources is impressively high, and I have a chart showing that. So only an initial estimate, which is this one from the Cyclades Islands, shows that out of the almost 120 rape allegations, only 23 defendants were tried for rape. 75 cases had involved, according to the legal officials, consensual acts of sexual intercourse, with 1/3 of the accused men being charged in the end with seduction, that's 24 cases, with the rest would see themselves acquitted, that's 52 cases, many of them because the legal prerequisites for seduction were not fulfilled, or because victim and perpetrator in the midnight got married. Even this very rough statistic shows, first, the small number of rape lawsuits that managed to reach the Greek courts of justice as such, and second, the large number of rape allegations that seem to involve long-term sexual relations. This is my talk today. So my main research question is why and under which circumstances those private sexual relations became a matter of public concern, and more importantly, as cases of violent sexual assault. I will propose some answers to this question in my concluding section, but let me first briefly outline the laws or set actions that I'm exactly as already presented, the law on rape, and examine legal practice through specific rape allegations with evidence of consensual sexual relations. Here I'm not alone, of course, I'm drawing on the wealth of the existing international scholarship on the history of rape, sexual violence and seduction, and especially on historical research on sexualized crime that reveals the complex meanings of gender, family and sexual relations, and the diverse linkages of sexual attacks with practices such as courtship, dating, marriage, and reproduction, research that enriches our insights into the life, social values, and gender ideologies of a lower urban and rural strata in different national cases, such as the UK, France, the United States, Canada, and several countries of South America. Since the dominant moral codes of the period in Greece condemned, as elsewhere and without exceptions, extramarital sex for women and celebrated virginity as a highly capitalized commodity for girls and their families, I will argue that a false rape report to the police and legal authorities was not an anomaly, or a specificity of these island communities was not a lie, but a key feature of an existing legal and extra-legal culture that recognized marriage as the sole positive outcome when girl had lost her purity, and at the same time a proof of an idiosyncratic use of the legal system by these rural populations. The repeated efforts to rehabilitate a girl that had been ruined by pressing her corruptor to accept responsibility for ruining her, and these words appear time and again in my sources, reveals their distinct sexual culture. It also exposes the then dominant moral codes of the Aegean communities and the various strategies individuals employ to serve them. Their intense efforts seeking atonement, as what follows will show, were anything but univocal. Ruined the girls and their families, if any, were trying to operate within the legal system as far as possible on their own terms. To do so, they were constantly switching between private, interpersonal, extra-legal, and public, impersonal, bureaucratic treatment of this incident. And sometimes they won, and sometimes they lost, and sometimes they managed something in between. In October 1924, in Chios Island, 18-year-old Eleni filed a rape lawsuit against Ioannis, a 23-year-old relative, the best man at her sister's wedding. Eleni testified that the previous August, Ioannis came to the family house while she was alone, said that he was in love with her, and then raped her. She testified that she could not defend herself at the time because she was bedridden with rheumatism. She also said that she did not charge him earlier because he repeatedly gave her promises of marriage, even at the time of the attack. Unfortunately, none of the more than 30 witnesses examined by the police confirmed her story, and the council of judges concluded that she was not telling the truth, and acquitted the owners of all charges. This case falls into a well-known pattern of rape prosecutions where the victim, especially when she's not considered a good girl, and Eleni was not, experienced difficulties persuading the authorities of her side of the story. What is more unusual with this case, though, is that the judges voiced in a wordy indictment the reasons behind the introduction of the seduction law to the National Statute Book in 1911 and clarified precisely what was the state protecting. And I'll give you a quote. "The law needed to accommodate women legally, but up to a certain age, where women are not in a position to clearly recognize the dangers threatening their moral status, lacking, due to their age, the experience and fortitude to set limits to men's provoking attacks. But beyond that age, it's dangerous to expand the web of legal protection, a web inextricably intertwined with the craftiness of mature women and their relatives, whose intention is to trap men into a marriage. Here the turns reverse and the wall of protection crumbles as justice cannot protect nor force a marriage and create unfortunate families and conjugal bonds that will so miserably fail." In spite of its claims, Greek justice was already protecting forced marriages. In 1911, the new strong liberal government passed not only a new constitution, but also an impressive variety of new laws regarding almost every aspect of political and social life, among them a seduction law that openly recognized the primacy of female purity and the restorative power of marriage when a girl had lost her virginity. The new law, under the official title Seduction of a Girl of Impeccable Morals, was an attempt to attune the Greek Penal Code with other European legal systems at the time, mainly the German and the Austrian. At the time, numbers in New York City, for example, as Stephen Robertson has shown, started to think of their own seduction laws as anachronistic and began to discredit them. I do not have the time today to go into details and discuss the different and at times contradictory juridical reactions to the new law. Let us keep in mind that while some legal experts celebrated its establishment, others expressed serious concerns, especially due to the difficulties they faced in their legal practice to define which girl was of good morals or which was not. In spite of those concerns, it seems that virginity continued to be used widely as a moral indicator for women. Besides this vague standard of good morals, the second prerequisite of the seduction law was a certain age limit for the victims below the legal age of consent, which was 21 since early 19th century. As Mary Ogden has shown, for the US legal officials and Karen Davinsky for her Canadian counterparts and other historians elsewhere, the Greek legal system similarly was drawing at more or less the same time a rigid line between good, meaning non-sexual, and bad, meaning sexual girls. It is not that this distinction was not already defined law in practice and gender and social relations in Greece, but now it was official, now it was a law of the state. The same amendment offered the defendant impunity in case of a marriage. So once again, law and lay morality seemed to overlap. Law historians today agree that the 1911 law on seduction constituted a serious backlash compared with the previous one, which was based exclusively on the age of consent, with no references to morals nor the restorative power of marriage. The same retreat shows a comparison with the then existing law on rape, first established in 1834, which was considered progressive for its time as it condemned sexual assault against any individual, regardless of gender, age, and marital status, and explicitly included in the means of coercion, not only physical, but moral and psychological violence as well. So let us turn now from the level of the law to law in practice, through specific rape allegations that involved consensual acts of sexual intercourse. The blurring boundaries between consensual sex and sexual coercion, in other words, the ambiguous intersection of seduction with rape, was a common feature of this incidence, but puzzled the judges in charge and deserves our attention as it reveals a selective use of existing legal categories by the subjects themselves that did not necessarily conform with official representations. And we'll come back to this issue later. Approaching this case, these cases from the plaintiff's viewpoints, mostly unfulfilled marriage promises, one can easily assume that for these rural islanders of the early 20th century, a strategic use of a criminal law was not uncommon. This was precisely the case from the following incident from Amorgos Island. In 1828, 25-year-old Sophia charged 24-year-old Stephanus with rape. When she argued that he coerced her while she was tending her flock across the plain. The judges, though, were not convinced of her claim. Her testimony was simple and short, lacking all sensational details and stereotypical elements that could make a rape incident plausible in their eyes. They concluded that this was not a rape, as Stephanus was unarmed and Maria was not found drugged. She was not able either to present visible signs of violence on her body, her face, or her clothes. And she did not have, after the incident, and these are the judge's words, the unavoidable for women nervous breakdown. Besides, ample witness testimonies confirmed that Maria and Stephanus were seeing each other regularly, and that the girl decided to sue him only after he repeatedly refused to marry her in spite of her being pregnant. The fact that Maria finally raped suit instead of seduction reveals a certain knowledge of the law's restriction. She was 24, way older than the age of consent and no longer protected by the seduction law. Instead, she tried to charge Stephanus with rape, a felony that was not subject to an age limit. The judges were convinced that Sophia was a victim of seduction after an unfulfilled promise of marriage, urged as an adult to add violent details to her story in order to press her, seduce her to make right for her. A big number of rape allegations in my sample come from ruined, often pregnant girls who were banking on the system of criminal justice to succeed in what they and their families had previously failed to do, to oblige their seducer to make up for the damage he caused. It was not their first concern to put him behind bars. In this light, a rape lawsuit was becoming a powerful weapon in their hands, pressing toward that direction. Too much was at stake. In Greece, as elsewhere during the same period, the laws of girls' purity degraded her value in the wedding market, limited her prospects of a proper marriage, and damaged her family's reputation, especially in the case of an unwanted pregnancy, which was not uncommon. The numbers of rape allegations and the time barred in my sample due to the prior marriage between the accused and the defendant are quite indicative of the effectiveness of this strategy. The fear of being criminally liable forced some of the accused men to proceed to marriage. A few relented only when their conviction seemed unavoidable, as Mikhail from Samos Island, who agreed in 1930 to marry Katina, only a few days before his trial at the Court of Appeal and 2 whole years after the rape lawsuit had incriminated him. No matter how awkward a marital union not based on free individual choice, but rather on the threat of criminal prosecution and possible convictions since today, it seems that for this island community, things were quite different. holding a realistic stance toward marriage when a girl was ruined, even more so if she was about to give birth to an illegitimate child. They would exert every effort to press the culprit. Under these critical circumstances, the middle class prescriptions of a proper marriage were of little importance. Besides, the idea of conjugality as a lifelong relationship based on psychic contact, spiritual affinity, companionship, and free choice owed much to the cult of domesticity introduced by the Greek middle classes. Its conventional language and her idealist requirements could be quite distanced from the common experience of less privileged social groups, and perhaps even for the majority of the middle class experts that wrote on marriage and sexuality at the time. In 1930, Kostas, while doing his stint in the Navy in Milos Island, met his underage neighbour Marina. Pretty soon they got engaged and started to meet freely. According to Marina's testimony, one day, when she was alone in the family's farmhouse, Kostas made his appearance armed and attacked her. After her fighting back for 3 hours, he managed to rape her. At this point, she said nothing to her family, but after suspecting that he might be dishonest, she confessed the sexual coercion. Kostas repeated his pledge to marry her in front of everyone in the house, including the family physician, who confirmed that Maria's hymen had been recently broken. A few days later, though, Kostas escaped the island along with Marina's cousin, apparently his secret lover. Immediately, the family filed a rape lawsuit against him. Yet Marina's testimony again did not persuade the prosecutor nor the judges who wrote. It is not normal an arm attack between fiancés because they are tender with each other. Neither does her stance the days that followed did not rape. Soon after the incident and up to the day the lawsuit was filed, she was extremely cheerful and said nothing to no one. Only when she became aware that the defendant's promises were false did she report what happened to her parents and press charges. So the basic plot of this story is quite common within the dominant sexual culture of these rural communities. Although relevant research is limited so far, it seems that premarital intercourse was not uncommon for the lower urban and rural classes, especially during engagement periods. For these young women, it was possible to engage in a sexualized relationship with a man they believed would soon be their husband. Even more so, an informal marriage expectation was a prerequisite for sexual intercourse, a promise that men frequently gave to women for several reasons, because this was actually the true intention, because a particular statement consisted an inextricable part of every heterosexual relationship, because this was the only way that men could persuade women to consent to having sex with them. Premarital relations would be stigmatized as immoral by the girls, their families, their communities, and the law itself eventually. Only when the seducer, instead of marrying them, left them ruined. So before concluding, I want to discuss briefly the common element of the fleeing disorder above mentioned incident, the fact that ruined girls, instead of pressing rape charges, they are pressing seduction, the opposite. Instead of pressing seduction charges, they're directing their charging rape charges in spite of the consensual elements of their relationship. So combining sporadic evidence from the penal law, legal practice, the dominant sexual culture and the prevailing social values in Greece, during the first decades of the 20th century, a few initial assumptions can be made. First, presenting a consensual relation as coerced seems a strategy employed by the plaintiffs that clearly shows a certain amount of knowledge of existing laws and a clear intention to operate within the legal system. In some cases, abused women would press rape instead of seduction charges because they were over 21 or they were afraid that they could not prove their impeccable morals because they could not overcome the restrictions of the seduction law. Some girls, they had even adopted the narrative of violent attack and coercion to publicly declare that they might have lost their chastity, but under circumstances of aggression and sexual coercion, a script that was, in Greece as elsewhere, in accordance with the presumed sexual nature of men and women at the time, that presented men as violent and active and women as quiet and passive. In addition, it offered withdrawing girls a chance to present themselves as victims and not as women who willingly, although they had been fooled, consented to extramarital sexual intercourse. However, the most significant motivation must have been the effectiveness of the rape lawsuit as a legal and extra legal means of pressure. Rape cases could well end in a 5-year sentence or more, while seduction attracted a far lighter punishment in most conviction with a 6-month sentence. Now concluding. The diverse meanings and practices of gender difference surface in the legal sources. Read there of men promising marriage one way or another, according to the legal fires, or the use of deceit, false promises, dishonest feelings, horrible lies, etc. Read of girls of impeccable morals, innocent, naive, honest, etc. Sooner or later give in to sexual intercourse. These girls would first try to solve the problem when it appeared within their families and communities. And in the end, they resorted to the state and the legal system, reporting their corruptors in order to press them to fulfill their promises, to punish them, to secure a father for their child, to restore their reputation before the eyes of the community, or, if nothing else worked, to gain compensation for all the above injuries they suffered. All these common stories from their own point of view reveal, among others, the centrality of marriage in those early 20th rural communities and the significance that heterosexuality invested in the marital bond in these specific cases as a cure for a wrong that had already occurred, as a remedy, compensation, and ultimately justice.
Maybe here is better.